So one of the really cool things about family life, or maybe in any kind of healthy relationship, is the way that it strips away all of the pretenses and we can simply be who we are with each other. At least that's the hope, right? When I'm with my family, I am not the senior pastor of a big church in Austin, Texas. I'm not the spiritual leader of a community of faith. I'm not the social justice advocate who's out on the streets for the poor and for workers' rights, although my Tea Party relatives have a lot of fun with that. No one stands in line at family gatherings to greet me. No one takes me aside into a corner and asks me for advice about complex theological or pastoral issues. More often than not, I am the object of a kind of loving tease. So over the last couple of months, my daughter and I have had a running discussion, I guess you'd call it that, about the location of one of the key fobs to her car. It turned up missing a few months ago, and I have been urging her to go to the dealer and get a new one. Everybody knows what a key fob is, right? That little thing that you have that goes beep, beep. Yeah, okay. What has slowed down the process of getting the new key fob is that age-old bartering that goes on between parent and child about who is going to pay for it, right? Since the responsibility for who actually lost it seems to be in doubt. Last week, Linda was, so this happened like over, you know, months ago. The key would just, you know, couldn't find the key anywhere. Linda was digging around, Linda, my wife, was digging around in the drawer of my desk for some envelopes. A drawer where we also keep all of the extra car keys. The drawer out of which my daughter's key fob disappeared. The drawer that I had searched in high and low for that key fob. And Linda said, "John, what's this?" You know where this is going, right? Yes, indeed, as if conjured up by a stage magician, as if it had materialized after a brief stay in an alternate universe somewhere, the missing key fob appeared, which allowed Lauren, my adult daughter, who could barely restrain gales of laughter, to recite her loving mantra to me, "Dad, you idiot." That's what you get at home, right? We live for that. How is it that we miss things that are in plain sight? I'm thinking that I rely so much on my sight that at times my sight makes me blind. I glance quickly here and there at this and that, and I think that, okay, I've seen everything, but I really don't see anything at all, and I miss all kinds of things along the way. Jesus asks, "Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear?" Guilty. Seeing in the dark may sound like a complete paradox, but I'm thinking that I have a lot to learn about the world, about myself, and about God from the dark. If you've ever spent much time trying to navigate in the dark, you learn how much you rely on your other senses. By some estimates, 70% of our sense receptors are in our eyes. When it's light outside, all of the other senses can just go on holiday, right? But turn off the lights, and the other senses come online. Maybe that's why food tastes better by campfire. Do you ever notice that? Why conversations in the evening are often so rich and so memorable? In the late 1990s in Zurich, there were four blind businessmen who opened the Blindecue restaurant, where you can eat a gourmet meal in pitch darkness. These restaurants are actually all over the world now, and there's even a traveling one that we had looked into perhaps having here as part of the sermon series, but it was a little out of our price range. Blindecue is the German name for the children's game that we call Blind Man's Bluff. The owners of the restaurant were inspired by a Swiss pastor who it sounds like maybe spent some time in Austin. He enjoyed blindfolding his guests who arrived at the parsonage when they came to his house. He said they paid more attention to the food, and the conversation improved if they couldn't see. In the dark, we learn what it means to pay attention. If you've ever left your campsite in the dark without a flashlight, because you left your flashlight in that mystery drawer where keys disappear and reappear. You have a drawer like that at home too, correct? And there is no full moon out, and you're walking away from your campsite, and the sky is clouded over. You have to remember that path exactly. And the tree that you touch so that you don't run into it, and that small bush that you sidestep, and the sounds of your feet on the path. There's a lot to learn in the dark. Could this be why Jesus says so often, pay attention? I think he probably clapped his hand when he did it too, just like that, don't you? Wait, watch, listen. She who has ears to hear, hear. Because clearly, we are not. On the wall of my office, there's a huge quilt. It's a gift of a choir at First Methodist Church in San Angelo. I was the associate pastor and music director there for 5 years. Around the edge of the quilt, it was a quilt given to me when I left the church. Choir members wrote messages. Most of them are just, you know, words of affection, we'll miss you, and all that. Except Jenny, who wrote, John, are you listening? Those of you who work with me can probably understand why she would write something like that. I read it often, though, as I leave the office. It's a kind of a touchstone to pay attention to my life. In spiritual traditions, we call this mindfulness. This is what we're doing with the raisin game with the kids. Paying deep and close attention to what's right in front of us, to what's going on inside us and outside of us. It can be a prayer, but it also can be an orientation to life. Mindfulness. I have to confess, so mindfulness, contemplation, this was not part of my religious upbringing at all. I guess I didn't learn it in seminary, and because contemplative practices were just poo-pooed. I mean, this was for the smells, and I went to a Presbyterian seminary, okay? So you understand that. And this was for the smells and bells crowd, right? Contemplative prayer. It should have gone away with the Reformation. Really? I mean, this is what I was taught in seminary in the 80s. Thankfully, over the last 25 years, Protestants have jumped into spiritual practices. One of our largest Sunday school classes here at University Church is Centering Prayer, led by our prayer diva, Jan Reed. I asked her for approval ahead of time for that title, and she said that she really liked Prayer Diva. What I've learned since seminary is that spiritual practices like contemplative prayer and centering prayer, they are not navel-gazing. Thomas Merton, who is an amazing guide on the contemplative life, teaches that when we are in touch with the deepest parts of ourselves, we are also in touch with the divine in us, with God in us. And we are also plunged into the heart of the world if we are paying attention. Meditation practices, mindfulness, contemplation, they are not for the faint of heart. Let me tell you that. They are not an escape from the world into some quiet, silent world cordoned off from all of the cares of the world, but they draw us deeper into the world, into sharing the struggles and the pain and the tears of all creation. Amen? Years ago, I came across the story of Jacques Le Seyrin, who was a fighter in the French Resistance during World War II. Le Seyrin lost his vision as a young child. It happened to him when he was old enough where he could actually remember losing his sight in an accident. His doctors at that time in the 19-teens and 20s, they recommended sending him off to a residential school, which in that time period would have completely marginalized his life. His parents said, no, we are not going to do that. And they decided to raise Jacques as a sighted child, as if he could see. They didn't pity him. They didn't call him unfortunate. They didn't say, oh, poor Jacques. They raised him as if he could see. In fact, his father would say, Jacques, always tell us when you discover something. And so he began a remarkable journey where the light outside him moved inside. Early on, he said, I completely lost the sight of my eyes. I could not see the light of the world anymore. Yet the light was still there. There was some. This was something entirely new, you understand, all the more so since it contradicted everything that those who have sight believe. The source of light, he says, is not in the outer world. We believe that it is only because of a common delusion. The light dwells where life also dwells, within ourselves. Now this sounds like a great spiritual metaphor, right? A light goes on inside of us, but Lucerum was serious. With practice, he learned that he could describe things for his friends. He would actually get into bets with them and won money off his friends. Describe things that he couldn't see. He could tell different kinds of trees apart by the sounds that they made as the wind was blowing through the leaves. Have you ever listened to a tree? Have you ever noticed that they speak different languages? Yeah, I'm going to have to pay more attention to that one. He could tell how tall or thick a wall was by the pressure that he felt in his body. Consider the lilies, Jesus said. Maybe because there is something right there in the shape and the sound and the heat and the touch of the lily that might save your life. Lucerne said, if we could learn to be attentive to every moment of our lives, we would discover the world anew. So back to Thomas Merton to close. Thomas Merton's first book was The Seven Story Mountain. It's an autobiographical book that he wrote about his early life. It was read probably by hundreds of thousands of people, still read today. In several places in that book, Thomas Merton suggested that, Merton was a monk, and he suggested that the cloistered life of the monk, that was the ideal toward which everyone needed to strive. Later in life, Merton said, I wish I'd never written that book. He was ashamed of how arrogant he was in the book, that he was holding up the life of the monk as that's the life that everybody should attain to. What he said later in life was, connecting with the larger world, moving deeper into the heart of things, that became the real theme of his life. One day after meeting with his publisher, Merton was at the corner of 4th and Walnut in Louisville, Kentucky, and he was just walking through the shopping district. He said he suddenly felt overwhelmed, that he loved everyone around him, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another even though we were total strangers. He saw the secret beauty of their hearts. It was as if they were walking around shining like the sun. If we could see each other like that, Merton said, there would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. To be awake, to watch, to pay attention, to be mindful, this is an act of love, my friends, for ourselves and for others. It's actually brave and risky. Without it, we will miss out on the great gift that God has given us. The gift of our one true amazing life. Thanks be to God for this gift. Amen? Amen.